senators going ahead with trying to get this legislation passed in Congress, or is that something that's kind of almost fait accompli at this point?
We're not really sure. It's still a huge issue because if he wasn't granted signatory authority, then that document's meaningless. They need his signature in order for it to be legitimate. So we're hoping to get some funds together and get some legal contacts and pursue some kind of legitimate legal avenue. I'm not sure exactly what that looks like, though.
Okay, Liz, is there anything that cable listeners who are supportive of your cause do to help out in terms of getting the agreement reversed or renegotiated?
Definitely make a lot of noise to Kitzhaber, as we always do. If anyone has any, you know, legal connections that they'd be willing to help out with, that would be really beneficial to membership, because there's a lot of members that have been, especially tribal employees, who have been forced to, they're suppressing information, and they've been forced to make decisions under duress. And so we feel like this is a violation of civil liberties for our membership.
How can they get in contact with you and the other tribal members who are protesting the agreement?
Anyone could email me. My email is godowatufti27@gmail.com, godowatufti27@gmail.com.
We've been talking with Kayla Godowa, descendant of a Klamath tribe's family, about the recent Klamath Basin Water Rights Agreement that was signed on Friday. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking to as many Oregon state judicial, legislative, and gubernatorial candidates for 2014 office as I can. And I've been talking to them all. Deep blue, progressive, liberal, democratic, centrist, independent, Republican, conservative, libertarian, deep red. Many of these candidates get ignored by the mainstream media, but they're not ignored here. Hear these interviews on my podcast at www.kboo.fm/betweenus. Listen to the people who want to lead you in 2014. Oregon State judicial, legislative, and gubernatorial candidate interviews at my podcast, www.kboo.fm/betweenus.
KBOO is looking for a membership director. Duties include database management, conducting mailings, producing reports, assisting members managing pledge drives, and of course, working closely with other staff members here at the station. The ability to work with numerous people in a fast-paced environment is essential. This is a mix of part-time and full-time work, with 40 hours per week being required leading up to, during, and following each membership drive. A full benefit package is included. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Our organization does not discriminate on the basis of age, race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, class, creed, physical or mental disability. For a more detailed job description and printable job application, go to kboo.fm, search for hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G. And to apply, please send a resume via email to hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G, at kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
The time is 6:03, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is Labor Radio at 6, and at 6:30, Prison Pipeline, followed by Hard Knock at 7. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide can be found online at redirectguide.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hi, good evening, everyone. This is Nick with Labor Radio. It sounds like Redirect Guide was part of the underwriting tonight. I wasn't aware of them. And you said social justice. That really rings true with me and a part of what we have on the show tonight. Everybody knows. Everybody's felt the pinch in the economy. And jobs, we all know, are going overseas. They're disappearing. And we see in the news, we read or we hear about now that the economy adds 100,000 jobs a month. But most of these are minimum wage jobs. People can't live on these jobs. Not when they're making underneath $10 an hour, but there's some movements out there and there's some people that are doing things to help bring about change, to fight for social justice, to increase our quality of life. And one of these people is my guest here tonight. This is Michael. How are you, Michael?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the organization that you're with?
I absolutely can. I am one of the members of the Portland branch of Socialist Alternative. We're a national organization that's fighting for the rights of, for lack of a better term, the 99%. We advocate advocate a form of democratic socialism, which essentially would it's an economic policy that would advocate for taking over the top 500 companies in the country, putting them under democratic control, run by the workers, the people who actually work in the company, and democratically by them and by the people who live in the communities that are affected by the companies that were the top 500 companies.
That's awesome. And so what kind of effect would this have in the community if people got to actually vote and participate in the governing of these companies? What do you think would happen?
Well, we would hope and we imagine that it would democratize the decisions made, obviously, in the company. It would change the directions of a lot of these companies, because right now most of them, if they're a top 500 company, they're all run for the most part for profits. You know, they run for the bottom line,
right.
And oftentimes that gets in the way of dealing with things like, you know, the global climate crisis or dealing with things like poverty or economic inequality.
Right.
So we would hope that by actually giving power and the control of the companies back to the people who run the companies, that that would actually do a lot to change the direction of these companies and essentially lead them down a path that would take us into a better future.
See, I think that would be amazing, because right now they're being ran by rich people for rich people, for rich people interests. And if the actual workers got to participate and have a say in what happened, and the people of the community got to vote and have a say in what happened, then it's going to start representing the interest of the workers. It's going to start representing the interest of the community. We'd see a total shift from where we are now, from a 99% versus a 1% kind of mentality, because everybody would actually have an equal say. You know, not just in a vote in politics, which they say can easily be controlled by the media, and who's got the most money to put their message out there, but the actual finances and the backing for that message would actually be determined by the community and by the workers. I think that's amazing.
Right. Absolutely.
So I actually love that you guys are the Socialist Alternative. We were speaking earlier, and I said when I was a kid, you couldn't use that word, socialism. That was a dirty word, but... You know, it's different now. I think people are ready to hear it and understand what it really is. And it's not what the USSR was. That was...
No, not at all.
That was a totalitarian regime ran by a dictatorship. You know, they had the ultimate say of what happened. And socialism, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's actually supposed to be for society, right?
Yeah.
Socialism is for society, and that's where everything should fall back to. And that's what the philosophy is behind that.
Absolutely. I mean, it definitely, there's a divide, I think, in our country in terms of how you view the term socialism. People who lived through the Cold War obviously would have a very negative viewpoint of that term, simply because it was indoctrinated into all of us. You know, we were beaten over the head with, and I can't say we because I'm not that old, but our country was beaten over the head with the propaganda of how bad socialism was. And if you see, you know, look at East Germany, that's socialism. So you don't want that here. You know, we have to fight that to keep our American way of life.
Right.
But I think increasingly since the fall of the Soviet Union and sort of the explosion of global capitalism, the realities of what that means are leading people to sort of question it and maybe seek alternatives. And we hope that they look to socialism and look to what socialism actually is, as opposed to what we've been told it is, or what we've been told for, you know, 100 years.
Right. And so what you guys have made some progress recently, right, in Seattle. What's going on up there?
So the Seattle branch ran a lady named Chama Sawant for Seattle City Council, and she won the seat up there. And so she's the first open socialist to be sitting on the Seattle City Council in over 100 years, which is really exciting for us. And her main campaign platform is the $15 minimum wage, and that's a really hotly contested fight up in Seattle right now. And they actually, our organization actually just filed a charter amendment to go on to the upcoming ballot. So within the next month to month and a half, we as an organization are going to be collecting signatures around the city of Seattle to get it actually put on the ballot in November. And then hopefully the folks up there will vote for it. Because if we leave it up to the politicians, the city council politicians, it may not happen. So we're basically at the point now where we're deciding whether we leave it up to them or if we have to go through with actually putting it on the ballot and letting the people decide by voting for it.
Right. And that's just it. I mean, when it falls back to the people, that's when there can be powerful change. You know, when it's just a council, when it's just some politicians, you know, they really can be. I mean, ideally they get in for altruistic reasons, but when you get in due to someone else's economic donation, you know, where's your allegiance really? You know, maybe you fall back to supporting their interests instead of supporting the interests of everyone, the community that you represent. Man, I really hope that charter amendment goes through.
Me too. I mean, you know, there's definitely going to be a lot of money poured against it. Obviously, you know, the Business Association of Seattle, or I forget the exact acronym of it, but, you know, the Business Alliance there, the restaurant organization of restaurant owners, and all the major businesses up there would be very much against that because that would cut into their bottom line. That would hurt their profits. And there was even recently rumors that one of the Koch brothers arrived in Seattle. You know, no one obviously knows what he was doing there, but presumably it was to help organize some sort of anti-raising the minimum wage campaign of some sort.
Sure, you never know. I mean, like McDonald's is Coke's number one customer.
Yeah.
They're the number one mover of Coke in the country.
Yep.
And so maybe in that regards, they actually could have similar interests in this campaign. A $15 minimum wage, though, some people argue that that's too drastic. Some people think that that is too great of a step and that minimum wage was never intended to be a living wage job. What would you say to those people?
Well, certainly when the minimum wage was instituted, it was likely put in place exactly as you described, you know, to be sort of a stepping stone for high school students to cut their teeth and to sort of learn some responsibility and to, you know, move up in the job market. And it, you know, did a good job of that for a while. But unfortunately, we're seeing now more and more jobs that are being created are minimum wage jobs. So if that was the intention originally, it is no longer what is the reality. So, you know, we have to deal with the reality because we happen to live in reality.
Right.
So actually, since the recession in 2007, 2008, you know, the 21% of all the jobs that were cut in the recession were minimum wage jobs. But in the recovery since, you know, the 6 years since, 53% of all the jobs that have been or the new jobs created have been minimum wage jobs. So that, you know, the concept of it being for high school kids to cut their teeth is no longer at all in play. And, and, you know, the vast majority of people who work these jobs are over 20. You know, they're people who maybe have, they're maybe single parents. They are, you know, maybe working two different jobs, supporting a family. And they maybe even have some college education, but they absolutely are not exclusively children. You know, they aren't high school students anymore. And they're people who need more money because if you have
desperately.
Yeah. Because if you have all these people getting paid a very little amount by the company they work for, then the only way that they're going to be able to survive is to A, go into debt, and B, to take some government assistance. So essentially, it's these big corporations that are benefiting from the welfare, you know, system that we have, from the food stamps and from, you know, the emergency room visits that a lot of people have to, you know, if they can't get good health insurance, they have to go to the emergency room when something happens, and then we all pay for that. So it's essentially a system of corporate welfare to leave the minimum wage as low as it is.
Right, absolutely. You know, I read that the average Walmart supercenter in America, the collective of that one store's employees will utilize $1.1 million annually in state assistance programs, welfare, it can be called.
Wow.
So, and, you know, and then other people I've heard argue saying that, well, you know, if people just work hard, if people, you know, just do their best at the job, then they're going to be rewarded and they're going to move up. They don't have to worry about being in a minimum wage spot. But I would say to that, you know, the owners of a company, they're not going to give out more money than they have to, especially when they do have competition. I think it's going to take political action. I think it's going to take a law that says, hey, this is the minimum that anybody's going to get paid. This is what we're going to do. And then it levels the playing field for everyone. And I think maybe it can level the playing field for mom and pops. You know, how else can they compete with Walmart?
Certainly. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of resistance to this from, I mean, business as a collective is the major people or the major organization that would oppose raising the minimum wage. But if you actually look into who is really behind that, it's the major corporations. It's the most profitable. It's the top 500 companies that absolutely are not in favor of this, and they put up this front of being all concerned with small business. And certainly, small business is something that we need to consider. I mean, this will be a drastic change for a company, you know, a company of 250 employees or less who maybe is just scraping by, paying all their employees what they are now,
right,
and that might be under $15. And that's something that will be addressed in whatever, you know, amendment or bill is put forward. But we have to look at the larger picture, and that is that the people who truly are opposing this are the ones who stand to lose the most because they have all of the wealth. You know, they're the ones,
right,
who withhold the wages that should be rightfully paid to the employees. Like, if you look at since 1968, you know, worker productivity has gone up so much. And so if the actual minimum wage had been tied to worker productivity today, it would be something like $21 and change.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, that's a, compared to what is it in Oregon? It's $8.95.
Something like that.
I mean, that's a staggering difference. I mean, that's the difference between living in poverty and,
right,
actually, you know, being able to save for the future, to be able to send your kids to college and to be able to take care of the healthcare needs you have, you know, it's the difference between having a good life and having a very terrible life.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's night and day.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what I hear when I read statistics like this, I'm thinking the difference between the $21 minimum wage that would be tied to productivity versus the $8.95 or so that it is.
Yeah.
That's all the money that's going right into some rich fat person's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making it all off our sweat and all off our backs. And it's completely disgusting to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's a company, you know, you have major corporations that provide a lot of the services for people in this country, you know, and the work that's being done in those companies is being done by the people. And yet all of the profits from that are going to individuals instead of going to the people as a whole.
Right.
And so that's what we as an organization, as Socialist Alternative, would advocate for, sort of taking a step back and looking at that system and seeing if that is really the most beneficial way to run an economy and to run a society.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe questioning that and thinking about what a better way to structure our society for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, right now, with the system of capitalism that we have, there is absolutely no way to deal effectively with the global climate crisis that we have,
right,
that's facing us.
Right.
I mean, because there's no profit in putting all of your money and resources into a new technology when you have oil and gas companies getting subsidized by the government to continue running the ill-maintained machines and equipment that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have some sort of oil spill, I mean, a lot of the, you know, they internalize the profit and they,
right,
externalize all the costs and all the, you know, the negative sides of it. So,
oh, sure. Yeah. How much federal money and how many federal personnel were sent out to, you know, off the coast of Florida when there was, yeah, a big oil spill over there from BP? I'm sure the cost to the taxpayer was easily in the millions.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole concept of what BP, you know, they were spraying that stuff Corexit so that they could push all the oil down from the surface, because how, I mean, they were being, the amount of money that they have to pay in terms of fees would come from how much oil was actually spilled. And so if they could just suppress how much oil anyone saw, then that's less money. You know, that's a couple $1 billion that they aren't paying right there.
Wow.
So all of their efforts, and this is documented, I mean, all the efforts that they put forth and for, you know, years afterwards went towards just sinking the oil down, so that no one saw it. And then when they got out of there and they, you know, they were said, all the beaches are clean, all of a sudden now we're seeing oils washing up again.
Yeah.
I mean, how is it going to go away? You know, oil doesn't, it's a finite amount of water in the ocean.
Right.
And you dump all that oil into it, it doesn't disappear.
Right.
It just gets sort of, you know, diluted, but it's still,
right,
there.
And it floats on the top and it spreads out and it's disgusting. And the sea life that floats in, you know, up into the beach, you know, it kills it.
Yeah.
It takes away from a quality of life, you know. When I was a kid, we used to, as a family, we'd go to the beach for a day, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to love that kind of stuff. It's sad to think that could be ruined due to a form of corporate greed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Gulf is essentially, it's a war zone now. I mean, so many of the people who lived off of the Gulf and off of the bayou are having to move or are absolutely not able to make it anymore. And that's the real cost of that disaster. And capitalism doesn't take that into account,
right?
Because BP didn't have to pay that fine. So, they don't care. There's no mechanism to provide for those people once the blame has been taken off of BP at this point.
And there's no incentive. For BP to do otherwise.
Yeah. Why would they?
You know, we were talking about the increase in productivity, and I can't help but think back to my grandpa.
Yeah.
You know, he was the sole provider for his family. He took care of grandma and their two kids, you know, my dad and my aunt. And off that single income, they were able to buy a house. They were able to have two cars. He was able to put food on the table every day. You know, and we're talking about technology from the 60s, 70s, you know.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to today where we've got computers that do so many things more efficiently than we do, you know. And then you go to McDonald's and they've got a robotic program that'll pour your soda for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's taken away work from there. Things should be cheaper. It should be easier and more efficient to do things. And yet these days on a dual income, people just scrape by, you know. So if anybody thinks that a $15 minimum wage is too drastic, I don't think it is. I think the problem is that it's too localized. If we could take this kind of a campaign national, you know, and so I think it's amazing that a place like Seattle is where it's all going to start, you know, and hopefully it just spreads out from there.
Yeah. I mean, the hope is that this campaign would be picked up by every major city across the country. I mean, I know that there's in Chicago, there's the Fight for 15, which is partnered with 15 Now, but it's, you know, they've picked up this number 15, which I'm not sure exactly who chose 15 in particular, but it roughly equals out to $30,000 a year,
right?
Which seems like a fairly reasonable base rate for everyone to be making in this country.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, the only way that this is going to actually take effect nationally and not just get, I mean, if it passes in Seattle, that would be wonderful. But if no other city in the country picks it up, eventually Seattle, you know, all the business moves out of Seattle and that city needs to find a new way to get to go about doing things. And so the idea would be that you have it get passed in Seattle, that sparks a wildfire that other cities across the country realize, well, if they can do it there, then we can do it here.
Right.
And it starts people, you know, thinking about it, and starts a movement that takes off across the country. And I mean, the federal government or Obama has proposed $10.10 an hour as the minimum wage raise. And, you know, that's admirable.
Which would be $20,000 a year. That's
right.
That's,
you know, like 18 to 20, yeah.
That's a lot less than a $30,000 a year job.
So, you know, that's a proposal to placate a lot of folks, I think. And in the same way that the Democratic Party does time and again with these sort of populist movements, they co-opt it and then deflate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like with the Occupy movement, you had the Democratic Party promoting, like, Occupy the ballot box and, you know, come vote for Obama because that's the only way that we're going to get this you know, fight done. And all of a sudden, it just takes the wind out of the sails of the populist movement. And the same thing, I think, is what they're doing right now with trying to push for, you know, a compromise at 10-10, which would still leave people in poverty.
It would, absolutely.
I mean, it would still leave people using government assistance, which doesn't deal with the problem, essentially.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I when you start looking at the big picture like that, $15 an hour seems low. $30,000 doesn't go very far if you got to feed a family. You know, if you had a couple and they were both working, you know, that's $60,000 a year. You can pay the bills with that. You know, $30,000 you might be scraping by. And you know, of course, the people with the money, Walmarts of the world, those kind of people, they don't want even $15. They don't even want to pay $15 to their employees.
No.
The people that show up every day and do all the work so that they can make money, and they don't want to spread it out.
I mean, yeah, it's just sort of a conversation that I think needs to happen, because I think that these realities are there in this country. You know, this is the state of our economy right now. We have a very, 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 very small percentage of the population with an unbelievable amount of the money.
Right.
And then the vast majority of us with very little amount of money.
Right.
And most people are turning on each other trying to figure out, like, well, you must be, the immigrants, they must be the ones taking my jobs, or it must be, the women who are making, taking some jobs away. I mean, whatever the argument that you would put forward that divides we as the 99% from each other.
Right.
And no one bothers, or I mean, people are starting to now, but for the most part, we are very, very much told not to look upward at the people who are really sort of putting their boot on our necks, And I think it's time that we all sort of recognize that we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's what Obama said in his 2012 inaugural or his acceptance speech.
Right.
We are all in this together, but it's time to actually understand what that means and to recognize that that means that, we need some sort of solidarity in this country, and that working people who are the majority of us actually need to fight for the rights of all of us. And the only way we're going to have that is if we can pull people out of poverty.
And I think, I think now is the time that people can actually mobilize for this kind of thing. They figured out, every time a group of people band together, they've always figured out ways to diffuse it. They'll label it global terrorism, which obviously no one supports terrorism. But but they can label that word to anybody that they like and then lock them in prison indefinitely. They completely can suspend somebody's rights. The Constitution says that we have the right to gather together and petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Yeah.
But now they've attached all sorts of stipulations to it. And if you get too many people out on a sidewalk, they can start arresting you. And all you're really trying to do is petition for a change.
Yeah.
And I think now for the first time ever, we've got enough on social media where it's not controlled by a few very rich people, they get to 100% control the message that gets out there. Now we're able to band together and actually educate people, and actually it's powerful how people can join together these days like never before.
Yeah. And I think that, what you just said is exactly the reason why, along with this discussion of sort of how the economics of this country needs to be rethought, we also need to understand what civil liberties mean on the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the internet is just an extension of our lives now, if all of our information is out there, if all of our banking information, if most companies operate in some form online,
right,
then we need to have a serious discussion in this country about what civil liberties in the real world extend online. Like, if you think about the police can come to your door and they are not allowed to enter your home unless they have a warrant.
Right.
But if you are, using online bill pay through a bank, or if you've, bought something from Target online or Amazon, the police can go to those information brokers who take that information from you and give it to the corporations and take the information from them without getting a warrant.
Right.
And essentially they, with this technology that comes directly into our living rooms and pulls information out, the four walls of our home have been knocked down because
absolutely,
you can circumvent the need for a warrant.
Oh, yeah. And it doesn't stop with the police. It's all sorts of governmental agencies.
Yeah.
Did you know the IRS, if they suspect that you may owe them money, they can suspend your passport. They can interrupt your travel. You can't leave the country.
Oh,
yeah. They can ground you. It's unbelievable and unreal. And I don't think people realize how far reaching it's gotten. And it's frightening.
I think that they're really, Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and all them went a long way to sort of opening our eyes. But I think that that was such a shock for everyone that we thought, okay, that must be the extent of it. Like, we know everything now, and this is scary, but we can kind of deal with this. And we have to remember that thus far we've gotten maybe 0.01% of all the documents that he stole, and he only stole maybe 1% of all the documents that there were to steal.
Yeah, if that.
Yeah. So, we have no idea. It's a drop in the bucket to what the actual reality of what our reality is right now.
Mm-hmm. So, for everyone out there listening, as a worker, these are very important issues to us. And I think that at some point everybody said, our options are so limited. We've got Republicans, we've got Democrats, one's our friend sometimes, the other's our friend seldom, but do you ever really feel like maybe they all just sort of represent one interest, and that's the people with the money? It's time for a neutral third party that doesn't take money from the people at the top that get to control all the messages. It's time for something new, something to change, something that's going to allow people to have a say, not just in the political landscape, but in the economic landscape as well. People shouldn't have to work you know, really, you're breaking your bodies, you know, construction people, but not just that, everyone, you're breaking your bodies at work so that someone else can get a little bit richer, and people should have a say in that. And that's how I feel. Michael, thank you for coming in. I understand that you've got an event coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. This Thursday evening at 6:30, it would be Thursday, April 24th, we have Trauma Sawant coming down from Seattle to speak. It'll be at the Westminster Presbyterian Church on Northeast Hancock, right in the Lloyd District, at again at 6:30. And she'll be speaking with local city council candidate Nick Caleb, mm-hmm. both of whom are running independent from any major political party, and both of whom need all of our support in order to turn the tide towards the populace, you know, towards the grassroots support for our political system in this country.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left here, and I just wanted to say, if you come to this meeting here on April 24th, 6:30, is that Westminster Baptist?
Yes, sorry, I may have said Presbyterian. My apologies. Okay.
There's a suggested $15 donation, yeah. And this sort of money is going to make all the impact, because like we said, with this new idea, we're not taking money from large, you know, business. It's not the 1% that's going to get to control this. This is a movement by the people, for the people, and what you can do is going to help tremendously. So this is Labor Radio, and everyone out there, thank you for listening. Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Organizing and Winning for 21st Century Movements, Wednesday, May 7th, 7:15 p.m. at Portland State University. The speakers for this event will be Steve Early, author of Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, journalist Aaron Gupta, founder of The Independent and The Occupied Wall Street Journal, and Joanna Brenner, retired PSU faculty member who writes on feminist theory and politics. Again, that's Wednesday, May 7th at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 238 at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.